session number 9794, reel 3.
Mr. Lewis, reel 3.
Yes, I have a note here that on the 25th of February 1943, we bombed Nuremberg, and in fact, we were held in searchlights over the target. And again, on the way to Berlin, on the 1st of March 1943, we were coned over Denmark, and I'm pretty certain that was in the area of the Kiel Canal. We were coned over Denmark for quite a long time, and we weren't shot at on that occasion. We were just held in searchlights. We were expecting a fighter attack, as far as I know. None was made, but we were held in searchlights quite a long time. I can remember that very well, because it's quite an experience.
Can you describe what it's like?
Yes, I mean, it is just brilliant, brilliantly lit. I mean, one has to remember that you're flying along more or less in pitch darkness. Maybe there's a bit of moon about, but suddenly to be held in, I can only imagine that it's rather like being on the cinema screen with many, many projection lights holding you, and brilliant lightness in the aircraft. You can, you know, it's an extraordinary sensation, really. And
then the pilot begins to throw the aircraft about.
Oh yes, the pilot would weave a bit, try and not lose too much height, but certainly. Because the pilot is weaving all the time. I mean, this is one of the, and I haven't explained this yet, but I'll perhaps do that afterwards. But certainly, held in searchlights, one certainly the pilot would weave around. Now, at a later stage in our tour, and I'll come on to that in a perhaps in a little more detail later on. We were flying with another squadron leader. I'll come to that. But he, in fact, just pointed the aircraft downwards and dived until we lost the searchlights. But by the time we came out of that, we were a bit too low, I felt. But anyway, we were held in searchlights, yes.
So presumably everybody was tense and scared whilst you were in the cone.
Certainly tense. I don't think scared is a correct word. I can't remember ever being, but I mean, things are different for everybody, I suppose. I can't imagine that people were scared because they were in searchlights. You're really wondering what's going to happen next. That's really more the sensation.
Now, I interrupted your narrative with you being on 214 Squadron at Chedborough.
Yes, well, we were there certainly flying with Squadron Leader Cook. By the time we had got to let's just have a look. By the time we had got to the end of March 1943, we had flown on 20 operations. Maybe one or two more. But certainly at that stage, Cookie, or Squadron Leader Cook, had flown the 20 operations that was fulfilled his second tour contract, if you understand what I mean. A tour of operations with Bomber Command, the first tour of operations would be 30 operations, which he had done before he came to us and collected us. By the end of March, he had flown another 20 operations, and that was his second tour completed. And at that stage, he left the squadron, and at that stage, we still had another 8 or 9 operations to complete, remembering that we had done one at Operational Training Unit. So Cookie went off. By that time, he had been awarded the DFC. In other words, he got the DFC, the AFC, and the DFM, and he went off to a conversion unit as a flight commander, and a squadron leader, Bilton, took his place as a flight commander at 214 Squadron, and we worked out the rest of our tour with him. In other words, we did something like 8 or 9 operations with Squadron Leader Bilton. he had not had the operational experience of Squadron Leader Cook. I don't think he was obviously a good pilot. I don't think he quite had the operational skill or was able to handle a Stirling aircraft with the skill of Cookie, but nevertheless we had an eventful half a dozen or so, or 8 or 9 operations with Squadron Leader Bilton, and they were probably the most exciting of our times, because we managed to get attacked by fighters and hit by fighters. We returned on 3 engines from Dusseldorf IC, and the fighter aircraft had managed, unbeknown to us, had punctured the tyres of a Stirling, which crashed on landing. I actually got hit by something from the fighter on that raid, and I finished up for, I had a little while in hospital, not for long, because I was operating again some 16 days later. We were also hit by flak when we were going to Cologne on the 3rd of July 1943, and it was a fairly exciting little episode in our operational time. But eventually, in July, the 3rd of Cologne 1943, that was our last bombing operation on a Stirling, and indeed with the Royal Air Force. And if we had have stayed on, if we'd have had one more trip to do, I believe we would have taken part in the first of the 3 big air raids on Hamburg later that month, because I'm fairly certain from what I have read that that operation on Cologne was the last mass attack before the Hamburg episode. That was the end of our bombing efforts with Bomber Command. Now, can I go on?
Yes, certainly.
At that stage, Cookie, and remember, he'd only been at the operational training, at the conversion unit, probably for a month or so. He was itching to get back into battle again. In other words, he wanted to get back onto operations. We hadn't even left 214 Squadron. He came over to see us. He said, look, he said, how would you like to have another go? Let's see what else we can do. And we said, yes. I mean, normally, in normal circumstances, you'll appreciate, we would have gone off as instructors somewhere or the other to operational training units or somewhere. And he said, look, I think it might be possible for us to get posted to Thamesford, which Thamesford was the air station from which, certainly at that time, from which all of the special duty flying was carried out. And by special duty, I mean under the aegis of the Special Operations Executive. There were a number of various types of, shall I say, secret operations carried out from Thamesford. They involved the dropping of agents into all areas of Europe, from Norway down to across to even as far as Czechoslovakia, further still into Poland, and down into the southernmost parts of France and all places in between. They involved also the dropping of supplies to the resistance forces, and there were a certain number of very special types of operation used, in which Lysander aircraft and Hudson aircraft were used, whereby those two aircraft actually landed on enemy territory and took in and collected people from occupied countries, mainly France. Well, we were enamoured with the idea of going to Thamesford, and I see that on the 25th of September 1943 we did our first flying at Thamesford, so I presume that was around about the date that we were posted there, and the notes which you have will bear out the actual posting dates.
Yes, it says 9th of September
43. There were certain skills required at Thamesford, which were rather different from Bomber Command, inasmuch as the it called for a great deal of accuracy from the navigator. It called for a high degree of flying skill from the pilot, and certainly the bomb aimer was also called in for much assistance as far as navigation was concerned. Why it was accurate was because, why it needed to be accurate was because wherever one was going, albeit Poland, or albeit the south of France, or Norway, one was carrying precious cargo in as much as they were human beings, and one was going to drop them in the midst of an enemy country, and one was going to drop them at an appointed place, insofar as they were going to be met. So one was not going to bomb an area in the middle of the Ruhr. One was going to navigate to a corner of a field somewhere. And this was achieved mainly by flying at fairly low levels. I wouldn't be too precise, but I wouldn't think that we were flying very much above 1,000 feet at night. And why it was necessary to fly at low levels, because we only operated during what we call the moon period. That was the times of the month when the moon was in its higher plane, from, say, half full moon up to half full moon down, a period of something like 12 days to a couple of weeks. One navigated mainly by map reading, because every aircraft in the squadron would be flying to a different point on the compass. The success of the heavy bombing raids, if one can say was successful, certainly was to send over a mass of aircraft in the space, in a very short space of time. In other words, to obliterate the defences. If you have a squadron of 12 aircraft wandering in all parts of Europe, if they were flying at normal operational height, they would be fair game for any night fighter, who would be vectored onto it, and they would be shot down almost certainly, without any shadow of a doubt. So the name of the game at Thamesford was to fly at a very low height, so that it was extremely difficult for enemy radar to come into play into locating aircraft, and almost impossible to, well, I would say completely impossible, to vector a night fighter onto an aircraft flying at that height at night. So that one really used map reading as the main source of navigation. Personally, I found the work extremely interesting. We had other aids to navigation. I can't remember too much about them or even what they were called. I think one was Rebecca and Eureka, whereby a transmitter could even be located with a reception party in France, and one could home onto that beacon. They were not commonly used. It wasn't every reception party that had them, because I seem to think we only used them once or twice at the very most, but they were certainly a marvellous means of identifying a target, a dropping point. There was an instrument known as an S-phone, and that enabled the pilot to carry on a conversation with the reception party using his intercom equipment, and they would have their equipment on the ground. Provided one got sufficiently near, one could speak to them and exchange whatever messages were necessary. Shall I explain how the dropping zones were marked out?
Yes.
It was necessary when dropping agents, or indeed parcels of supplies to the resistance parties on the ground, that one flew at fairly low heights. One would fly as low as was safe to get a body jumping out of an aircraft down to the ground as quickly as possible, and without avoiding and thus avoiding any possible sightings from the enemy. This means dropping at something like 750 feet. One, of course, in those circumstances must fly the aircraft into the prevailing wind to slow the traversing of the aircraft across the ground as much as possible. And so the reception party, apart from identifying themselves as such, they would also identify an ideal course on which to drop, in which to fly, to drop the passengers, and they would do this by a series of maybe four or five lights, mostly handheld torches, which would be arranged roughly in the shape of a cross, and one would fly up the stem of the cross and make your drop at the intersection. Our trips from Thamesford involved going down to the south of France, a couple of trips to Norway, into Germany itself. That one always surprised me, because we had an agent dressed up in German uniform, I remember. We did a couple more trips to France, another one to Norway, and then I think I mentioned to you that the squadron were in fact operating as far as Poland, and that was quite a long flight for wartime conditions, from the UK up to somewhere like Warsaw was something like 15 hours, between 12 and 15 hours. Apart from the danger of the flight itself, it was almost at the complete endurance of a Halifax, and we were flying Halifaxes then. They just couldn't hold any more octane. And a number of crews were being lost, particularly over the Baltic, to night fighter attacks. Somebody had the bright idea of going to Poland via the Middle East, and we did in fact fly out to Algiers, and thence from thence on another day, the following day probably, to Brindisi, and then we flew from Brindisi on an operation across Yugoslavia and the Balkans up to Warsaw, and back. And that, in fact, really was not a very long... It took 9 hours, that particular operation from Brindisi, which was much, much shorter than the 12 or 15 hours, and I suppose very much safer. It was a navigational hazard in as much as one had little or no knowledge of flying in those territories. But nevertheless, we certainly navigated very accurately into Poland. My bomb aim did some brilliant map reading up the Vistula, I remember it vividly. And then we made our way back to Brindisi very successfully, making a good landfall. And it was quite an uneventful trip, really. But I always felt it was an achievement.
Did you have any contact with the agents?
What used to happen was that the agents, or some of them, I mean, I wouldn't know an awful lot about it, but certainly there was a training area for agents not an awful long way from Thamesford. And I believe they had sort of courses of training, which probably took a few weeks. And at the end of the course, a number of agents would be ready for dropping during the next moon period. It was not uncommon for that particular training school to throw a party prior to the moon period, at which a number of aircrew from Thamesford would go over. And I remember going over there a couple of times and having very good parties, so that one did mix with agents. One never knew, one didn't know them, wouldn't necessarily know their nationality, but one saw and exchanged drinks with them and this sort of thing. At the squadron itself, I remember distinctly squadron leader Jo Thomas coming to Thamesford to talk to us and tell us something about what he was doing in France. Nothing too much, obviously, but also, and I remember emphasising how desperately important it was for us as crews to drop those agents as accurately as possibly could be done, because some of our trips, and I haven't mentioned this, some of our trips were indeed blind drops. That means there was no reception party, and the agents were relying very much on an accurate drop for their own goodwill.
What kind of impression did your Thomas make on you? Have you got any memories of him?
I remember seeing him very well, yes. I remember him as a very forceful character, a rather dynamic character. I seem to have a short, wiry man that spoke to us quite forcibly, and he wasn't afraid to make his points very firmly, and perhaps complain that we hadn't been doing as well as we might in some of the dropping operations. It was a short talk, probably half an hour or so, but I remember it very well indeed.
But presumably you didn't realise at that time that he was something very special.
No, I know his widow is a very good friend of mine now, but
So I interrupted you with you explaining the geographical spread of the operations that you were doing to the Vistula and so on.
Yes, and really that was the high point, I suppose, the trip to Poland. We got back to base on the 23rd of December 1943, and January 44, we did 30 minutes flying. We did two air tests during the whole of the month. That was because the weather was appalling at that time of that particular month. We didn't do any operations, and one would normally expect to do at least three or four during the 12 days of a moon period. We did no flying at all that month. Obviously, the weather was bad. February, I remember there being a bit of a flap on because there had been no flying in January, there must have been a build-up of agents for whom it was important to get them transported into France. Obviously, the planning staff knew, they must have known by that time that there was going to be an invasion 6 months hence, and that it was important, I suppose, to get as many agents into position doing their training and whatever else, other things they did with the resistance in the early part of the year. The fact that there was no flying in January must have been a bit of a nuisance. And in fact, the squadron in the moon period earlier in February, I remember the weather still was appallingly bad. We had not done any flying, but I recall that I think three or four nights running, and I knew this because we were the flight commander's crew, the crews in the flight were going here and there, and they were coming back with their passengers because they just couldn't make it to the dropping zones. Bad weather. There was one particular agent, and I can name him now if you like. You know the name Francis Camouts?
Yes.
Apparently it was quite important for Francis to be got down to the south of France. Weather had frustrated it. I think there had been two attempts to get him down there, both of which had proved abortive. And I remember we were briefed on the 7th of February. We had done a successful trip to France on the 4th of February ourselves, which took 7 hours. We must have got well down into the south of France for it to take in that period. Probably on the... I rather think that may have been down to Bordeaux or somewhere. Down to Bordeaux, yes, in that area. Because the territory would have been easier for flying over. But we were briefed on the 7th of February, 1944, to take an agent. Of course, we didn't know it was Francis Camouts then. We had no idea who it was. To take an agent to an area just close to Marseille. We gathered that attempts had been made to take this man there unsuccessfully, that it was absolutely imperative that he was got there, and that we ought to do our absolute damnedest to make it a successful mission. We were an experienced crew, and we set forth in appalling weather from the airfield. I think we took off straight into cloud, and I don't think I saw ground anymore until I landed from my parachute.